This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Linda Mottram. Tonight, a marginal seat wins new mental health funding, but mental health leaders give neither major party a tick for their policies. Also, why some political journalists enjoy The Drop. The ABC's hidden campaign project looks at a key tactic of spin doctors that's skewing reports and leaving you in the dark.
If you observe the embargo, it restricts your ability to go out and seek comment before that. But the other thing is, there's this culture of not biting the hand that feeds you.
And energy politics dominate the campaign for the key Queensland seat of Flynn. But many locals are more worried about access to basic healthcare.
Absolutely disgusted with the whole system. I mean, we've got nothing here. And it's the GPs are just so overworked by the people coming from the hospital that aren't adequately serviced there.
Welcome to the program. One of Australia's leading voices on mental health has accused both major parties of lacking serious interest in improving the nation's mental health. The Coalition has announced funding for mental health services in the marginal seat of Bass in northern Tasmania, an area that has lacked access to services. But Ian Hickey AM says that once again, mental health funding commitments are inadequate and says the issue's been buried during the election campaign. Isabel Rowe reports.
Mental health funding is a personal issue for Bass MP Bridget Archer.
I have suffered from poor mental health for a lot of my life. I have anxiety and panic disorders and having a bit of a panic attack when I walked in here this morning. So I'm in the right place.
The Liberal MP won her seat by just 563 votes in 2019, and she's now under pressure to hold on to it. Prime Minister Scott Morrison returned to the state today, passing protesters on his way into a mental health service with more cash in hand. He's promised more than $45 million in federal funding for mental health services across Tasmania, including three of the government's head-to-health clinics for Burnie, Devonport and Outer Hobart.
And what happens here is on-the-spot support, care and advice without needing referral, without prior appointments, without charging out-of-pocket expenses. This is the sort of missing middle service that is desperately needed in mental health across Australia.
Professor Ian Hickey AM from the University of Sydney's Brain and Mind Centre has accused the government of using crucial funding to buy votes.
These are key issues, issues that people will actually vote on in their local electorate. These are national issues that are being played out in every region of Australia, not just the marginal electorates.
Labor's key mental health policy this campaign has been to reinstate funding for telehealth psychiatry sessions, allowing regional and rural Australians to access bulk billed services. Professor Hickey says neither party has done enough.
It's surprising to me that Labor has not made more of a fuss about mental health. It has a very experienced shadow minister in Mark Butler, who was previously a cabinet minister in these areas, and again is well aware of what the issues are. I think there's a general impression that the government has promised a lot of money and we should just wait and see what happens. The Commonwealth really has the means to do this. The Commonwealth has not wanted to be accountable at the local level. It's tried to push this back to the states. But the Commonwealth, through their primary health networks, has a primary responsibility to sort this out in every community in Australia.
During the campaign, the Prime Minister has also announced a new head-to-health centre in Parramatta, another marginal seat in Western Sydney. But the government has signed mental health funding partnerships with each state and territory, many of them announced before the election. Health Minister Greg Hunt says there is money for many more centres.
70 head-to-health centres around the country, 164 headspace centres, and now 15 kids head-to-health centres, and these will save lives and protect lives. I have no doubt about that.
The Prime Minister has been accused of exacerbating mental health problems for young transgender people during the campaign, after backing his candidate for Warringah, Catherine Deaves, as she declared transgender teens were being surgically sterilised and mutilated. Asked for her take, Bass MP Bridget Archer says the issue should be treated gently.
We know, and I have spoken previously, that LGBTIQ community members are some 15 times more likely to suffer mental health challenges and be at risk of suicide. I think we all should be very mindful of that.
In the seat of Flynn in regional Queensland, Labor leader Anthony Albanese was announcing a battery manufacturing precinct for the industrial hub of Gladstone.
We need to rebuild manufacturing in Australia. One of the lessons of the COVID pandemic is that we need to be more self-reliant. We need to make more things right here.
And he's further clarified his position on who should get a wage rise, after indicating he'd like to see the Fair Work Commission boost the minimum wage to keep up with inflation. Mr Albanese says he means the absolute minimum wage, not those on industry award rates.
The Fair Work Commission draw a distinction regularly. When they look at the minimum pay, minimum wage and the national wage case, they draw distinctions about that all of the time. What I am talking about here is people who are on $20.33 an hour.
Anthony Albanese had been criticised by the Coalition and some economists for backing higher wages because of a concern that that could lead to even higher inflation.
Isabel Rowe with that report. Well, the election campaign has again been marred by burgeoning mis- and disinformation, from doctored core flutes claiming candidates are something they're actually not, all the way to the almost no-holds-barred social media landscape. Through it all, quality journalism helps to sift the chaff out for voters. But there is one type of journalism that grows out of the sometimes unhealthy symbiotic relationship between reporters and politicians, where facts, context and alternative views are jettisoned for the quick exclusive. It comes via what's known in the Canberra Parliamentary Press Gallery as The Drop. The ABC's Stephen Hutchin is part of a team writing about these hidden aspects of the election campaign for you, and he has a piece on ABC Online today on the concept of The Drop. I asked him to explain it.
Not to be confused with a leak, and not to be confused often with a press release. A drop is usually a clandestine bit of information dressed up as a press release that is passed on to a single reporter or multiple reporters. And it doesn't become part of the official media release register. It's just a note with an embargo on it, usually, that often has quotes that you can use, which you cherry pick, and then information highlighted. All sides of politics do it, but it's usually more likely to come from the government side.
Can you give us an example, perhaps, of what a drop would look like? What characteristics does it have?
Yeah, well, in the story that I've written today, there's an example there from a drop by Josh Frydenberg that was issued in February the 13th, to be exact, which was a Sunday. Sunday's always been a slow news day in journalism and a great time to drop a story. And then I went back and looked at the articles that had been written the following day or that had been published that evening based on that drop. And I found a couple of examples. When I went back to look at the text of the articles and compared that to the drop, it was quite obvious that in many cases there'd just been a rearranging of the details in the drop, and there had been no attempt to balance out what was given in the drop with either third-party experts or the opposition. And this was a very technical drop about women having done better out of the tax cuts that the government had announced than their cohort.
So it's the kind of drop that's going to give the government a good headline, a positive headline, which, what, then ministers can presumably go on and leverage it further? How do they do that?
Well, that's right. They do love, and this is all sides of politics, they do love getting it in print first, because from there they can leverage that to appear on, as it happened in this case, breakfast TV in the morning, radio programs, where the same talking points can be mentioned and amplified.
And social media, do they use the publication of the drop to give themselves some push in social media as well?
Well, yes. Dennis Muller from University of Melbourne mentioned when I drew this to his attention. He said the duplicity is amplified on Facebook. Then I noticed a correlation between some of the posts and some of the drops. You could match the drops that became stories, then became Facebook posts. And of course, in Facebook, it reaches a whole usually a different audience. But also on Facebook, you get very little context. You don't even get a link to the story. You just get a screen grab of the headline or a facsimile of a tear out of a newspaper saying, you know, this, this and this, which then gets commented on, shared, et cetera, et cetera.
Now, Labor does the same.
Yes. There's a historical example I wanted to pull out. It's still on the Media Watch archives from 2013, where the Minister for Transport, who at that time was Anthony Albanese, dropped a story about a very fast train. That was circulated among various publications. But one of the points of that Media Watch article was that one of the reporters called it out, saying that they were required not to seek third-party comment on that drop, which is very honourable and should be done more often.
Yes, because it's standard journalistic practice, isn't it, to verify, fact-check, go to other sources. Why are journalists not doing that, apart from that one notable case that you just mentioned?
Well, I think there's a combination of factors here. There's the pressure of time, because often these drops are dropped late in the afternoon, say, so you may not have the opportunity to go out. But often, as I said, they come with embargoes, say 10 or 10:30 or midnight. If you observe the embargo, it restricts your ability to go out and seek comment before that. But the other thing is there's this culture of not biting the hand that feeds you.
Mm. But of course, this doesn't serve the public interest very well.
No, and that's one of the points of this project on the ABC that I'm working on, the Hidden Campaign, is that we want to show the public things that might not percolate to the surface that are happening in the election. You have to have been reading newspapers and news articles a long time to be able to decode some of the elements that are in the story. People don't read as deep anymore.
Yeah. Stephen, great work at the Hidden Campaign. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Linda.
ABC journalist Stephen Hutchin. And to find stories from the Hidden Campaign team, go to the Australia Votes section of ABC News Online. Well, in many parts of regional Australia, residents have to wait weeks to see a GP and travel hours for specialist care. The industrial city of Gladstone in central Queensland is a case in point. Gladstone is in the key LNP-held seat of Flynn, and Labor leader Anthony Albanese was there today talking up plans for battery manufacturing. Energy does seem to dominate politics in this particular electorate, but many locals say inadequate healthcare is just as important. John Daly reports.
Smokestacks at a nearby coal-fired power station are visible from the pre-poll booth in Gladstone's industrial area. The incumbent LNP member is retiring here in the seat of Flynn, and Labor candidate and Mayor Matt Burnett is up against the LNP's Colin Boyce. But a lot of voters here say healthcare is on their minds, not energy.
I'm Tony. I'm voting for Maddie Burnett.
What's your key issue, do you think?
For me, services where it's medical services in regional areas. I think it's healthcare is a problem with most seats, yeah. But for us, for travelling, yes.
Yeah, okay. And you've had personal experience with that?
I've had a few, and family has, yes.
Oh, hi, I'm Karen. I voted for Labor. In Gladstone, I guess healthcare is critical, especially at our age now. It's a concern in Gladstone that most people that need specialist attention can't get it in Gladstone. And I think we need, you know, there needs to be a bigger emphasis on national healthcare rather than states, because it's so different everywhere. So
yeah.
I'm a bit concerned about that.
Okay.
So,
do you need to make another appointment at all?
No.
There's a chronic shortage of GPs in Gladstone. Nicole Dickhout owns a local GP practice, and she hasn't been able to take on new patients for years.
God, we've been close to new patients for the last 5 years because we saw that we couldn't look after our population of about 10,000 regular patients. A lot of elderly people are very worried about their future in Gladstone, and we're talking about people who've been here all their lives, who've worked very hard here and who love the region, but who are considering to leave, and many of them have done so.
Nicole Dickhout says the situation is being made worse by what she calls an underfunded and understaffed public hospital. The Gladstone Hospital has an emergency department, but specialist care is very limited, so people rely heavily on local GPs for help or have to travel hundreds of kilometres to Rockhampton or Brisbane.
They cannot do too much, so they give pain relief and go back to your GP. when the doctor decides to send them back into the Gladstone Hospital, they often keep bouncing between the GP and the hospital, and then you end up sometimes with very serious health issues, and I mean extremely serious health issues. So we do hear about preventable deaths in Gladstone as well.
Jeanette is a patient who has experienced this firsthand, having been turned away from the local hospital with a gallstone and chronic pain. She says eventually it was her GP's diagnosis of jaundice that sent her to Brisbane, where the stone was surgically removed.
Absolutely disgusted with the whole system. I mean, we've got nothing here. Mm. And it's the GPs are just so overworked by the people coming from the hospital that aren't adequately serviced there.
Gladstone's public hospital is a state government responsibility, and a spokesperson for the Central Queensland Hospital and Health Service says Gladstone's emergency department waiting times are among the best in the state. The spokesperson says new services would be introduced when it's safe and sustainable to do so, and a new $42 million emergency department will drive further improvement. At a federal level, the LNP has promised $146 million to fix the GP shortage in regional areas, including more training posts for rural generalists and more places in a well-regarded pre-vocational junior doctor program. Labor has promised to match that funding. But Nicole Dickhout isn't convinced it will fix Gladstone's healthcare issues.
Everything else that has come out recently in these announcements, I heard the LNP one, for instance, but I also hear a lot from Mr. Matt Burnett. They're not making a difference. It's just political lip service.
PM asked to interview Flynn's Labor and LNP candidates. They did not respond.
John Daly with that report. This is PM. I'm Linda Mottram. Ahead, a hail of criticism of Australian golfer Greg Norman after he dismissed Saudi Arabia's killing of a dissident journalist, saying everyone makes mistakes. Well, three suicides of serving and retired Northern Territory police officers within the last 3 months have prompted frontline officers to demand an urgent increase in funding for mental health services within the force and the wider community. At the funeral of one of the officers yesterday, the police commissioner promised to do better to tackle the problem of inadequate supports that the police union has been raising for years. Jane Barden reports.
Yesterday, the NT Police Association President Paul McHugh went to the funeral of one of three former colleagues who've died by suicide. Next week, he'll go to another. The union has been appealing for years for more mental health services to tackle a rising tide of post-traumatic stress disorder that he says is now at crisis point.
The same message keeps coming through is, whilst the services that are available are good, they're nowhere near enough. Unfortunately, our chaplain in Alice Springs has moved on and still yet to be replaced. We've got wellbeing and health officers, one in Alice and two here in Darwin. The one in Alice is about to move on and still no replacement there.
The officers are dealing with really tough situations all the time, really. But are there some particular things that have been different about this period?
No doubt the pandemic has played a huge role in the impact on resourcing, for example. Together with losing so many police over the last couple of years and trying to keep up with replacing those officers, that's created a real situation that's challenging for those that are left here to try and pick up the pieces. I think there's been some real challenges as well in relation to discipline processes.
NT police face particular challenges, dealing with very high rates of drunken domestic violence and injury night after night, many isolated road crashes, and having little backup support in remote stations. Former NT Police Sergeant Paul Milne left the force in 2017 because of debilitating PTSD.
We were getting absolutely smashed. Like every shift we'd have a death, or we'd be going through a critical incident like a sexual assault or a fatal. It was taking a toll.
The toll took him unaware.
One of the last ones was trying to save a lady's life on the Mary River. We're doing CPR on a riverbank, and I had to fire a few rounds into the river because there was a lot of crocodiles coming up onto the bank. Then one came within, I don't know, half a metre of me, so almost got taken. Unfortunately, she passed away. But these things creep up on you. You don't expect it at the time, and you're at home and you're crying. And then the next day, you're crying again. It's like, well, you know, you think to yourself, maybe I need to speak to someone. But then you've got the stigma and the culture of the police saying, oh, you shouldn't talk to anyone.
Despite fear of losing his career, he sought help, but had to move to Victoria to get specialist mental health services.
And I realised there was just nothing in Darwin, like there was no facilities, no support to assist me in my recovery.
He's devastated hearing about the latest suicides.
If three teachers had committed suicide, it'd be all over national news. What's going on? Why isn't someone doing something about it?
The NT Police have now held a review into the problem. Paul McHugh says there are some hopeful indications that more mental health services will be promised for the force and in the community.
People need to know if they are going to try and remove the barrier of the stigma and they do get to the point where they say, I need to talk to somebody. They don't want to hear that, I will get you an appointment in 3 months or 2 months.
The NT Assistant Police Commissioner Michael Murphy says the review will result in more practical supports.
Critical incident debrief, access to psychologists, occupational therapists, social workers, chaplaincy, off-site clinicians as well. We need to invest more in those services.
At Officer Michael Dutram's funeral yesterday, Police Commissioner Jamie Chalker also promised more resources and cultural change. Asked whether her government will provide the funds needed, the NT Police Minister Nicole Manison offered a statement promising a stronger delivery of support and wellbeing services for officers. Paul McHugh says the force can't afford to wait any longer.
The gentleman I'll be going to his funeral next week was a squad mate of mine. I know him really well. But we want to make sure that out of this sadness comes some positive steps to making sure, you know, more is done for our police, not just now but into the future.
NT Police Association President Paul McHugh speaking with Jane Barden. And for help for yourself or anyone you know who's struggling, Lifeline is a service you can call. The number is 13 11 14. Well, Sweden and Finland are edging closer to joining NATO, precisely the opposite of what Vladimir Putin hoped for when he launched his aggression against Ukraine. Finland has said this afternoon that it's in favour of applying for NATO membership, paving the way for the alliance to expand towards Russia's border. Sweden, right next door to Finland, is expected to decide on joining NATO in the coming days. The war, meanwhile, grinds on into its 78th day, with news that Ukrainian forces have liberated territory around their second biggest city, Kharkiv. Nell Whitehead has more.
Residents have started returning to the villages around Kharkiv, or at least what's left of them. Tatiana Pochivalova has found her home in ruins. She says she hadn't expected such aggression, such destruction from a brother nation. Where am I to live? How am I to live? She asks. Ukraine says its forces have liberated territory around the north and east of Kharkiv, pushing Russian soldiers back towards the border. In Kyiv, Ukraine's first war crimes trials are getting underway. Almost 11,000 crimes have been registered by the office of its prosecutor general. It's now charged a 21-year-old Russian prisoner of war over the alleged murder of an elderly civilian. He was gunned down while riding a bicycle in the Sumy region in northeast Ukraine. And every day, new evidence of Russian atrocities is emerging.
This is a stark example of a potential war crime perpetrated by Russian forces.
CCTV footage obtained by CNN shows Russian forces shooting two unarmed civilians in the back. There's no sound, only video, but it shows the men, both working in a vehicle dealership outside Kyiv, talking to the soldiers and then turning to leave.
Behind them, the soldiers they were just talking to emerge. A few more steps, and their bodies drop to the ground.
Atrocities like those have steeled Western resolve. Today, Finland has announced it's in favour of joining NATO, and Sweden is likely to follow within days, a major strategic shift for both countries, ending long histories of non-alignment. Mick Ryan is a retired Major General in the Australian Army.
Certainly, Putin's demonstrated willingness to use force to achieve his objectives, I think, has quite worried many in the European community and has showed them that if you're not a member of NATO, you're probably more vulnerable to the predations of countries like Russia than if you are a member of NATO.
An expansion of NATO's landmass would be a huge strategic blow for the Russian president. He said that preventing Ukraine joining NATO was one reason for his invasion. But rather than undermining the alliance, he's reinvigorated it.
There's not many examples from contemporary history where a leader like Putin has done something that's resulted in exactly the opposite of what he hoped for.
As Sweden and Finland edge closer to NATO membership, Britain's Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, has signed mutual security declarations with both countries, meaning their militaries would support each other if they came under attack. Mick Ryan says it's reworking the whole European security architecture.
Well, one of the assumptions that Putin went into this war with is that the West probably wouldn't assist Ukraine. Not only has that assumption been proven wrong, but I believe we're going to see a massive shift in how Europeans conceive of their own security. We've already seen Germany significantly change its national security posture and funding for defence. You're probably going to see emerge out of this a different European security architecture. All of this is because Putin decided to invade a southern neighbour, a country that was basically brothers and sisters to the Russians all the way through the Soviet era.
Retired Major General Mick Ryan speaking with Nell Whitehead. Well, everyone makes mistakes. That's been Australian golfer Greg Norman's dismissive response about the Saudi regime's brutal murder in 2018 of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi, a regime he's making a lot of money out of. His response has caused widespread outrage after weeks of questions over his controversial role fronting a lucrative Saudi-backed series of golf tournaments starting in the UK next month. Samantha Donovan reports.
No audio of Greg Norman's comments appears to have emerged, but the Times newspaper in London is reporting he brushed off questions about the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi at a media conference, saying, "Everyone's owned up to it, right? It's been spoken about from what I've read. Look, we've all made mistakes and you just want to learn from those mistakes and how you can correct them going forward." Greg Norman is the frontman for the LIV Golf Invitational Series, which is being funded by Saudi Arabia's sovereign wealth fund, the PIF, to the tune of several billion dollars. The UK's Sky Sports News had earlier interviewed him about the controversy surrounding the tournament. Reporter Jamie Weir asked Mr. Norman if he understood golf fans may be concerned that the funding is coming from a brutal, murderous dictatorship.
100%. And it's reprehensible what's happened with Khashoggi, right?
Mm-hmm.
Own up to it. Talk about it. But you go back into Saudi Arabia, they're making a cultural change within to change that. They want to change that culture, and they are changing the culture.
Yeah.
And you know how they're doing it? Golf.
Are they? It was 2 months ago they executed 81 men in one day.
Hey, I'm not going to get into politics. I don't know what the Saudi government does with their political side of things. I don't want to get there. But every country, Jamie, every country got across the bar.
Greg Barton is a professor of global Islamic politics at Deakin University. He says Greg Norman's comments on the murder of Jamal Khashoggi are horrifying.
This is particularly tone deaf and insensitive and just atrocious, really.
He said everybody has owned up to it, meaning Saudi government officials. But is that the case?
No. A number of people have been thrown under a bus, perhaps with good justification. But Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, who's now driving the ship in Saudi Arabia and ostensibly claims he's driving cultural reform, modernising the economy, you know, sport being part of that, he very clearly has his fingerprints all over this assassination. He gave the orders. Khashoggi had upset him. He ordered his assassination in the most brutal fashion. And he hasn't owned up to that at all. There's no acknowledgement.
One of Greg Norman's defences for his involvement in this tournament series is that he's bringing cultural change or helping bring cultural change to Saudi Arabia and more kids are out on the golf range.
It would be good if it were true. I mean, the basic premise of cultural change in Saudi Arabia is not entirely without hope, but of course you've got to judge actions, not words. When Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, took up his role, his effective leadership of the country, because the king is very old, he said a lot about cultural change, including encouraging women into public life and shifting Saudi Arabia away from oil into information technology and information age. Some of that has been borne out, but unfortunately, there's been a lot of brutality and inexcusable behaviour, including regular executions, the continued detention of political prisoners, dissidents, including many women, really really horrible things that suggest that, this leopard hasn't changed its spots.
Professor Greg Barton from Deakin University, Samantha Donovan with that report. And that's PM for this Thursday. I'm Linda Mottram. Thank you for listening. Hear us live or later on the ABC Listen app or head to the PM webpage. Check out the ABC Australia Votes podcast for more on the election and do join Samantha Donovan for more PM tomorrow.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.